Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ben Bernanke said today, if the economy needs more help, the Federal Reserve stands at the ready. But of course, that's another way of saying, I'm not going to act now. What does it mean when the Fed says, private sector, it's up to you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care associate 24/7. And by Yellowbook 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Ryssdal. Welcome to Friday, August 27th. It's great to have you here. All right, consumers, all right, businesses, the recovery is in your hands. That's essentially what Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke said today in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. He declared the Fed is ready to do whatever it takes to support the recovery, but that central banks can't do it alone. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains what that means.
What Bernanke's saying is that we need to start spending money again. Businesses, too. Mark Thoma is an economics professor at the University of Oregon. He says the idea is that monetary policies, for example, lowering interest rates, can only do so much.
And so at some point, you have to see people willing to take investments, start new businesses, expand, do all sorts of things, which will start to bring employment back and start to bring confidence back.
That sounds like a circular argument. We have to spend money to improve the economy, so we'll feel more confident and spend more money. The argument may make economic sense, but a lot of people, including Thoma, think it's going to be a hard sell. Businesses already have lots of capacity they're not using, so why should they invest in more? And regular people, they've lost their jobs or are afraid they're going to, or they want to pay off the debt they've been running up for years. Robert Frank is an economics professor at Cornell's Business School. He says it's the government that needs to start spending money. He suggests something like a national project to repair the interstate highway system. It's work that needs to get done, and it's big enough to get the economy going.
The construction workers would get salaries. They would spend them in stores. The merchants would stock new merchandise. They'd place orders to refill depleted inventories. Factories would start producing again.
And that, in turn, would give other businesses, not to mention the rest of us, the confidence we need to restart the economy. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Like Elisa said, businesses have lots of their own problems to worry about. A few of the top companies just got handed a new headache today in the form of a great big lawsuit. Microsoft's co-founder, the billionaire Paul Allen, is suing some of the world's largest high-tech companies. He claims they are running key parts of their business using technology developed by a cutting-edge research lab that he founded back in the 1990s. Marketplace's Steve Henn joins us now. Steve, who is Paul Allen suing?
Well, you know, he's covering the entire alphabet of tech companies here, starting with AOL, Apple, eBay, Facebook, Google, all the way to Yahoo and YouTube. There are 11 defendants, but there are a couple notable exceptions. Allen is not suing Amazon or Microsoft.
Yes, I noticed that. Both of them based in his hometown of Seattle.
Yep, that's right.
So what is Allen claiming here?
Well, he's claiming patent infringement. Back in the 1990s, Allen spent a couple hundred million dollars funding a technology lab called Interval Research. This was a big industrial research and development laboratory. Initially, they weren't supposed to create products at all, but do cutting-edge research that looked at what would be possible in the future. And it was sort of modeled after the famous laboratories at Xerox PARC Labs, which invented the mouse, and Bell Labs, which invented the transistor.
Early big think stuff.
Exactly, big think stuff. But Allen always hoped that his laboratory would actually create products that he could profit from. It never quite worked out that way, though.
What are some of those patents?
He did a couple of things that are really important to how the internet works now. One of the patents involved in this case allows sites like Amazon or Netflix to recommend to consumers other products that they might like. Another patent that is in dispute here allows news consumers to quickly search the net for stories about the same subject they're already reading about.
Yeah, this is fundamental stuff to some of these giant web companies. And did Paul Allen ever do anything with those ideas back then?
He really didn't, but he doesn't have to. In the last couple of years, an entire industry has grown up around patent enforcement. There are companies and investors that don't really make any products, but instead buy up patents they believe are being infringed upon and then sue the companies that are actually using the technology. Patent attorneys who usually work on the other side of these lawsuits refer to these investors derisively as patent trolls.
Mm-hmm.
But there are billions and billions of dollars at stake in these suits. And no matter how this case plays out, folks in the patent litigation law firms around this country are likely ecstatic. It's going to be a full employment act for patent attorneys.
Hmm. All right. Well, somebody's got jobs. Marketplace's Steve Henn, thanks.
Sure thing.
On Wall Street today, investors headed into the weekend saying maybe the future's not so bad. We'll have details when we do the numbers. In the sports pages today, we saw a modern story of risk and return. Steven Strasburg is one of the best and best paid rookie pitchers in baseball history. He has thrown some amazing games. But the Washington Nationals ace has torn his elbow ligament, and he's probably going to have a procedure known as Tommy John surgery. Now, what that surgery means is Strasburg will recuperate for a year and a half or so, but when he comes back, he'll likely be as strong as ever, maybe stronger. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports Tommy John surgery is changing the business of baseball.
The procedure's nickname comes from the first player to have it done. Tommy John had pitched 14 seasons of pro ball when he had what everyone thought was a career-ending tear to his elbow ligament. Then in 1974, a surgeon replaced that ligament with a tendon taken from Tommy's forearm. Less than 2 years later,
Tommy John went on to have a very successful career as a pitcher.
Russell Huffman is an orthopedic surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania. He says with a 90% rate of success, Tommy John's surgery has given thousands of athletes a second chance at play.
And some will say, you know, my elbow feels stronger than it has in years. And that may drive players to say it's not a bad thing. It could be a good thing to undergo this surgery.
High school players, even little leaguers, are increasingly going under the knife. Paul Marchetto operates on young athletes at the Rothman Institute. He says sometimes it's a scholarship on the line.
Some do feel that, well, you know, this is my ticket. I want to go to college with my baseball, and I really do want to go through it.
For baseball team owners, Tommy John's surgery has become a kind of insurance. The Nationals gave Steven Strasburg a record $15 million contract. John Vrooman is a sports economist at Vanderbilt University.
Well, if he has a career-ending injury, then that cash flow goes away, and I think what Tommy John does is it just kind of cuts off this risk.
And makes teams more willing to throw big money at an arm that hasn't been tested in the major leagues. And since studies show that the hardest throwing pitchers are most likely to need a Tommy John, it could make everybody play a little closer to the edge. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Well, we were not able to bring you a ton of good news this week, but at least we moved on from what the economy hasn't done to what it might be able to do. So, from lousy housing to a GDP downgrade to Ben Bernanke's vision of the future, let's capture the week that was on Wall Street and beyond with financial journalist Heidi Moore and Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Good to talk to you both.
Good to talk to you.
Good to be with you, Bill.
So today, Ben Bernanke said the Federal Reserve will run alongside next to the bicycle, but he thinks the private economy will learn to pedal on its own. You buy that, Heidi?
No. But I think it's a very optimistic point of view, and I think it's actually very useful in the sense that Bernanke is basically signaling to people that there is a limit to what the Fed can do. And although he did indicate, again, some mystical stimulus measures that he has in his back pocket, it does show that he wants the economy to start running on its own instead of depending, you know, on the sort of Santa Claus aspect of the Fed. So in that respect, it's good news. But whether the private market actually wants to deal with what's going on right now is another question.
Well, Bernanke was obviously looking at this morning's GDP news. We found out the economy didn't grow nearly as fast as we thought it did this spring. Does that help him decide what to do, or does he ball that report up and throw it away because he's looking forward? Sudeep?
Well, the GDP report really shows that what we've been seeing for the last few weeks is now confirmable with numbers in the broadest sense, that we've seen this slowing down. We've lost the momentum that we had earlier in the year, and we're getting closer to that point of a stalling economy. Until you actually have job growth, people are going to think that the best days for the country are behind us. But we just don't know until you have some kind of a snapback. And the only question is, what will cause the snapback?
Heidi, what will cause the snapback?
It could be anything. The thing is, we don't have any visibility. And I think that at a certain level, you know, kind of the discussion of the double dip recession and GDP growth and all of that really shows how abstracted we become in thinking about this recession. I mean, the real pragmatic, hands-on, difficult issue is unemployment. And the Fed can't do anything about that. So whatever causes unemployment to be reduced, whether it's corporations finally using what's on their balance sheets to hire people, whether it's government infrastructure spending, whether it's, you know, something having to do with trade or import and export, something needs to happen to get unemployment moving. And then maybe we will see a real practical recovery, because the recovery that we talk about right now is all very theoretical and just at the highest level of academics. People aren't feeling it in their real lives.
Everyone is looking to somebody else right now, and that's the big problem with this cycle that we're in. The private sector says that they need to have job creation in order to expand. To have job creation, you need consumers to spend more, and consumers aren't going to spend more without seeing the unemployment rate coming down and seeing job creation.
Well, the other big news this week was about our so-called housing market, home sales at record lows. Must that change before the rest of the economy wakes up or not?
The key to the past recoveries has been the housing sector. And so if the housing sector isn't doing what it has done historically, which is react to low interest rates through home buying and home building, then it's almost become a symbol of what has failed us so far in terms of the stimulus, in terms of the snapback that we've always seen. And it will probably continue to be, because it's going to be weak at least for the next year, and prices aren't going to go anywhere for a while.
Guys, I'm going to have to file this entire conversation under futile angst unless you give me some kind of hope into the weekend. Any silver linings?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think it's a matter of psychology. So what Ben Bernanke did correctly in his speech today was he spoke about the future in optimistic terms, and he spoke about his faith in the private markets in optimistic terms. And that reminds people that we weren't always in this state where the government did everything for us. And that could really help change psychology. And since we're in a vicious circle, as Sudeep said, that switch in psychology over time could be very valuable to getting people to invest, to create jobs, and to buy products to keep boosting the economy.
Financial journalist Heidi Moore, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, always great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Coming up, when a hurricane destroys your home.
People were actually going and knocking on people's doors with paper bags full of money, saying, I want to buy your house.
5 years on, a new look at New Orleans. But first, let's do the numbers. An upbeat end to the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average charged up 164 points, or 1 2/3% to close at 10,150, so back above 10K. The NASDAQ packed on 34 points, 1 2/3% to 2153. The S&P 500 added 17 points, and that was 1 2/3% to 1064. Now for the week, the Dow lost 0.6%. The NASDAQ gave up 1 2/10%. S&P 500 reversed 0.7%. 5%. The lawsuit by Paul Allen we told you about didn't touch the tech shares today. Yahoo up 1 2/3%, Apple up 0.5%, Google rose. Bonds fell, so the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for July. Who won? What did they wear? Tune in everywhere for Emmy Recap Madness. The primetime awards show is Sunday night. And if you're in the Emerald City, you get a little extra reading time courtesy of the recession. Seattle Public Library locations closed for a week due to budget cuts. No materials will be due and no fines will accrue. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke, in for Kai Rizdahl. When you can't decide what to buy, you are no longer on your own. There are so many websites that are rich with user reviews on all kinds of products. Yelp and Amazon are just a couple of famous sites. But what if that review is really just a marketing trick? Today, the Federal Trade Commission settled a case that deals with marketers who review their clients' products online, and funny, they don't disclose their motives. Reporter Miguel Helft covers technology for the New York Times. Miguel, welcome to Marketplace.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the case the FTC settled today.
Well, last year, the FTC put on some new guidelines for fake reviews on the internet and fake blog posts that purport to be from ordinary people, but they're basically written by people who were paid to do those reviews. Yesterday, it settled its first case under those guidelines, and it was against a PR company in California that was apparently giving good reviews to its clients, which were mostly game companies that had games on the Apple iTunes store. And they were giving them 4 and 5 stars and saying these are great, great games, and they were not disclosing that they were being paid to do so.
And what are the rules on that?
Well, the rules are very similar to what they are in the real world. There's been guidelines against deceptive advertising for years, and the FTC is now enforcing those guidelines on the internet. But essentially, if you are being paid to pitch a product, you should be upfront about it. You know, reviews from users are pervasive online, and so are fake reviews. The question is, it's challenging for companies to police them, but some companies do a better job than others.
Well, I don't think we're even surprising most listeners when we say that fake reviews are pervasive. It just seems almost impossible to enforce on the net.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost impossible for the FTC or anyone else to catch every last one. I think what the FTC and the New York Attorney General brought a case last year, what they're hoping is that by picking a few hopefully high-profile cases, other people will stop the practice or at least curtail their efforts to do these kinds of fake reviews.
Well, are we getting into a fuzzy territory of telling people they can't puff up stuff? They don't have freedom of speech on the web?
Well, that's quite interesting because when the FTC announced its new guidelines for the internet and for social media last year, a lot of bloggers were very concerned that they wouldn't be able to just speak freely or, you know, post a tweet saying I like this thing or not without disclosing even tenuous connections. This first case that the agency brought suggests that they're not going after the casual blogger who's, you know, referring to a product, but essentially after professionals who are paid to write fake reviews.
So what about you, tech reporter for the New York Times? How do you approach that wild world of web opinions?
Well, I don't have terribly strict guidelines, but I think one of the things I look for is lots of reviews. So if an item on Amazon is rated five stars, but there's only two reviews, I'm going to be a little more suspicious of the reviews than if there are 60, 70, or 80 reviews, and that gives me at least a gut level of comfort with it.
So if marketers want to fool you, they've got to put more time into it, post a whole bunch of reviews.
That's right.
Miguel Helft is a tech reporter for the New York Times. Miguel, thank you.
Thank you.
When Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast in August 2005, the first focus was on the immediate victims. Then the question was, what is this catastrophe going to do long-term to New Orleans? Now that we're 5 years from the storm, we are looking in on the city. It turns out tens of thousands of people chose not to go back to damaged neighborhoods, but a lot of people have restarted their lives nearby, as near as the other side of the lake that flooded their homes. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports on a booming economy next door to New Orleans.
On the north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, across from New Orleans, sits St. Tammany Parish. Thousands of people came here from the south shore to ride out Hurricane Katrina. They figured they'd stay with relatives in Covington or get a hotel room in Mandeville, thinking they'd be gone a few days at most. But after the levees broke, many of them didn't have homes to go back to.
The scramble for housing was frantic.
Enter a woman for the times.
I'm Susan Amin, the real estate queen.
Amin says in the days after Katrina, the North Shore real estate market was surreal.
People were actually going and knocking on people's doors with paper bags full of money, saying, I want to buy your house. Will you sell me your house?
Amin remembers hugging, sobbing South Shore clients who'd lost everything. But she became a taskmaster when showing them homes to buy. She'd say,
look at this house carefully now. You'll have to decide before you walk out the door if you want this house. The decision to buy or sell a home is one of the more major decisions that you have to make in life. These people were having to make it in 5 or 10 minutes.
In many cases, clients weren't looking for just one house. Whole families relocated together.
Hey, Eve.
Come on in. You found a place all right, huh?
Dan Johnson evacuated from St. Bernard Parish, just downriver from New Orleans. His neighborhood flooded 15 feet. Then a storage tank tipped and spilled 1 million gallons of oil into that floodwater. Homes sat in that for days. 22 members of the Johnson family lost their houses. The group relocated en masse to the piney forests and subdivisions across the lake.
You know, so all of the family is pretty much together, you know, within 10 minutes of each other.
He says about half of St. Bernard Parish, up to 30,000 people, did the same. Dan's wife, Gloria, and his mom, Dee, say they got a new name.
St. Tammanards. St. Tammany and St. Bernard combined.
St. Bernard transplants that they called it St. Tammanard when we first came over.
The Johnsons say St. Bernard has come back to life with new families. But those who transplanted elsewhere aren't compelled to go back.
Flooding, rising waters, they never want to see that ever again. It was too emotional to go through that again.
And it's still close enough to New Orleans that they can cross over without any problem.
To cross between New Orleans and St. Tammany Parish, you take one of the longest bridges in the world, the 24-mile causeway over Lake Pontchartrain. It can be a beautiful drive, all sky and water, when there's not a traffic jam. And increasingly, there's not, because people can now get the New Orleans experience on the North Shore. There are dozens of stores and restaurants I recognize from the city. They're set in landscaped strip malls instead of sidewalk storefronts.
Good morning, I can help you.
Including a branch of the New Orleans coffee and beignet stand, Café du Monde.
An order of beignets and an iced café au lait to go.
With a drive-thru.
Yeah, $1.49 to change. Pull up to the next window, please.
St. Tammany had the fastest-growing economy in the state when Katrina hit. You could say the storm accelerated a process already in motion.
Call it 10 years in one day.
Brenda Rin Burtis heads the St. Tammany Economic Development Foundation. She says business and residents have been trickling out of New Orleans and across the lake for years. They came for better schools, less crime, and new houses. Burtis says after Katrina, Chevron pulled its office with 500 employees out of New Orleans.
When they polled their employees, they found out more than 50% were living over here already.
Chevron built a new office in St. Tammany. Two other oil and gas companies relocated there, too. And there's new business in addition to New Orleans' corporate refugees. A tech company just moved in from Silicon Valley. Burtis says the area could be on track to become a bigger economic center than New Orleans.
You're going to see more people driving from the South Shore to the North Shore for work.
She says you could look at that as a loss for New Orleans, or you could see it as a victory for the state of Louisiana. All those contracts might have landed in Houston or Atlanta. On the North Shore of Lake Pontchartrain, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
We have a lot more from Eve's New Orleans coverage at our website, including an audio slideshow of how three of the most devastated neighborhoods are bouncing back. Join us at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
Well, it's Friday, and I think we've earned a treat. Let's step away from the stuff you need to know and get to the stuff that it's just fun to know. Courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
George Judson, Managing Editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Eyelashes for cars.
At last! What are you talking about?
A company is selling fake eyelashes that you put on top of your headlight. It's just like putting flames in your car.
Except totally uncool.
But why not?
I guess so.
Why not have car tattoos?
That's true. You can get
a little car body piercing.
Oh, I have those. A bad parallel Parker gave me those for free.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Apparently, people hate unselfish coworkers.
This explains my popularity here at Marketplace.
Yes. Apparently, a study from Washington State University found coworkers who always volunteer for things and are always volunteering to do extra work, people hate them.
So do-gooders actually undermine the performance of a company.
Exactly. So you should leave early and do as little as possible.
See, I told you I was an exemplary employee here.
You should get a raise.
Patty Hirsch, senior editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The Pet Insurance Awards.
Do explain.
Well, there's a pet insurance company that gives awards out for the most outrageous claims that people make for their animals.
All right, and the winner is?
Well, let me tell you what didn't win. The border collie that dived through a plate glass window to get at a mailman. And then the winner was a Labrador that ate this beehive that was chock full of pesticides and thousands of dead bees.
Oh, my. They recovered, right?
Yes, of course. Insurance kicked in and helped them out.
And what did our winner receive?
The bronze trophy in the shape of a ham.
Good dog.
Man, I do hope that doggy's okay. Let Rico and Brendan help you ease into the weekend with their podcast called Dinner Party Download. You'll find the link to that at our website, marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow charged up 164 points, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ packed on 34 points. That's also 1 2/3%. And the S&P 500's addition of 17 points. Yes, 1 2/3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, how do you save for retirement when you're scared of the stock market?
I don't think it's terribly surprising that we're seeing young investors so risk-averse, given that they have seen nothing but flat to down markets in their own personal investing history.
So much for the optimism of youth. I'm Bill Radke. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.